Livehackers, good day to you wherever you are. Just before the quarantine, I had a chance to talk to Professor Nir Eyal, the best-selling author of Hooked and Indistractable, and right now it feels like this conversation is even more important than it was before. How can we actually stay focused while we're at home? How can we accomplish what was planned? And how can we teach our kids this most valuable skill to be able to do the deep work, not to be distracted by each bleep ping and any sound coming from the cell phone? Please welcome Nir Eyal just after this sound.
Nice to meet you and to see you.
It's likewise. Thank you. Good to see you.
I see that you have Hooked over there. I have a printed copy, the Russian version of Hooked.
Nice. All right. You have the Russian edition. I don't think Indistractable has come out yet in Russian, but I think it's, is it coming? Yes. I think it's coming in Russian. I have a list of languages here.
Nir, I have recently discovered your blog on medium.com, and there you describe yourself or call yourself a behavioral designer. Can you please explain to my listeners who and what this person does?
Yeah. So a behavioral designer uses tactics from consumer psychology, behavioral economics to change consumer behavior. So my work life and what I taught at Stanford for many years was this topic of how can we use these tactics facilitated through technology to help people form healthy habits in their lives. So over the past 5 years, since my first book, Hooked, was published, companies like Fitbod have used the Hooked model to get people hooked to exercising in the gym. Companies like Kahoot, the world's largest educational software, get kids hooked to in-classroom learning. I've worked with companies in the media like the New York Times to help get people hooked to reading the news every day. And so the idea is that we can use these same tactics that the big tech companies like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Google and WhatsApp all use these tactics. My idea was, look, they've known these tactics for years. What if the rest of us could use them to help build healthy habits in people's lives? And that's exactly what's happened.
You work individually as well.
Right. So Hooked is about how do we build habit-forming products. Indistractable is about how do we change our own behavior. And specifically, it's the other side, right? So if Hooked is about building good habits, Indistractable is about how do we break the bad habits. And that's something that's written for the individual, not necessarily for the company. Mm-hmm. Although there are sections in the book that are about how to build an indistractable workplace.
When I read Indistractable, I just called it like an antidote for the Hooked book, because we kind of, in the Hooked, we discover what corporations do to us and actually what we can do as businesses. But Indistractable is more on the customer side. What can we do not to get into this net?
Yeah, I think that's right. That it's because I understand the Achilles heel of how these products are designed to be so engaging that I think I can offer a sober and well-informed perspective on how we can make sure that we don't succumb to the unhealthy habits. Now, the audience that I write for, you know, the products are different. I didn't write Hooked for Facebook and Instagram and Google. They and the gaming companies, they've known these tactics for years. The book came out in 2014. These companies were founded way before that. My idea was to democratize these tactics so that we could use these techniques for good. So if you find that you overuse one distraction or another, whether it's, you know, too much news, too much booze, too much football, too much Facebook, whatever the case might be, Indistractable is that antidote to help you do whatever it is you say you want to do in life.
Can we get to the foundation of it all? Why do we get distracted in the first turn? Yeah. Why does it happen to us?
Right. So the best place to understand what distraction is to understand what distraction is not. So the opposite of distraction, most people will tell you, is focus. But that's not exactly true. The opposite of distraction is not focus. The opposite of distraction is traction. That if you look at the origin of both words come from the same Latin root, trahare, which means to pull. And you'll notice both words also end in the same six letters, A-C-T-I-O-N, that spells action. So traction is any action that pulls us towards what we want to do, things that we do with intent. The opposite of traction is distraction, any action that pulls us away from what we plan to do. So you have traction and you have distraction. And this is really important because anything can become distraction and anything can become traction. That we tend to think of only some products as being distracting, right? Facebook and video games and things like that. But I argue that anything can be a distraction, right? So if you sit down at your desk and you say, I'm gonna work on that big project. I'm gonna do what I said I came here to do. Here I go, I'm gonna do this hard thing without getting distracted. But first, let me check some email, right? Let me just check that one thing on my to-do list real quick. It feels like a work-related task. It feels like I'm productive. But if that's not what you plan to do, it is just as much of a distraction. So, and in fact, I think it's a more pernicious form of distraction because when you're, you know, watching a YouTube video or playing a video game at work, it's pretty obvious you're distracted. But when you're checking email, oh, that's worky. That's a productive task. But you don't realize it is just as much of a distraction because that's not what you plan to do. And you're letting distraction trick you, to fool you into prioritizing the urgent at the expense of the important. So anything can be distraction. And I would argue that anything can be traction. That I can't stand these Chicken Little tech critics that say how the sky is falling and technology is so terrible. We should all stop using Facebook and YouTube and these tools are melting our brains. And it's just not true. And in fact, there's nothing wrong with these tools if we use them on our schedule. So we can actually turn distractions into traction by simply deciding when we will use them. So we can talk more about that, but now we have the base of the model. We have traction and distraction on two sides. Now we need to ask ourselves what leads us to traction or distraction. And here we have what we call triggers. And there are two types of triggers. We have external triggers and internal triggers. External triggers are the pings, the dings, the rings, all of these things in our environment that can lead us to either traction or distraction. Most people blame these external triggers on, they think that this is the problem, but in fact, that's not really true, that most distraction does not begin from outside of us, but rather most distraction begins from within. That the root cause of most distraction is not the external triggers. It's not the pings and dings and rings. It's what's happening on the inside. And this is called an internal trigger. That internal triggers are uncomfortable emotional sensations that we seek to escape from. And so this is the answer to your question. Now that we understand what is distraction and what it is not, the root cause of distraction, of all distraction, is one thing. In fact, it's the root cause of all human behavior. That everything that we do for one reason. It's not what most people think. Most people think that that motivation is about the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain, but that's not true. That in fact, the root cause of all of our behavior is one thing, and that is the desire to escape discomfort. That everything we do is about the desire to escape discomfort. Even the pursuit of pleasurable sensations, wanting and craving and desire, lusting. There's a reason we say love hurts, because wanting is itself psychologically destabilizing. So we know this to be true in the body when we think about our physiological responses. For example, if you go outside and it's cold, the brain says, this is uncomfortable. You should put on a jacket. If you're hungry, you feel hunger pangs, and that tells you to eat because your brain doesn't like the discomfort of feeling hungry. And so physiologically, this is common sense. The same holds true psychologically, that when we are lonely, we check Facebook. When we're uncertain, we Google. When we're bored, we check the stock prices and sports scores and Reddit and Pinterest or the news, right? We much rather think about somebody else's problems than have to think about our own issues. So we use all of these distractions to escape an uncomfortable reality. That this is the root cause of all procrastination, all distraction. It's not a character flaw. There's nothing wrong with you. It's that you just don't know how to cope with discomfort in a healthy way that leads to traction rather than distraction. Because if we agree that all human behavior is prompted by a desire to escape discomfort, what that means, therefore, is that time management is pain management. And this is really, really important. This gets to the heart of your question. Anytime we don't do what we say we're going to do, it is always an issue of uncomfortable sensations that we are trying to escape from, whether it's through too much booze, too much news, too much Facebook, too much football, whatever the case might be. We are using something to get out of that uncomfortable state. And so we have to understand that principle so that we can do something about it. And so that's why the first step to becoming indistractable is always mastering the internal triggers, understanding what is causing us that discomfort, fixing the source of the problem, or where we can't fix the source of the problem, learn tactics to cope with it in a healthier fashion.
The best way is just get to the root of all the negative emotions that we have. Not to avoid, not to run from them, but just to get into them and kind of feel them and go through them and realize why we feel them.
So there's four key steps, right? The first step, that's the one we're on around mastering the internal trigger. There's a lot of different techniques you can use, but there's only really two strategies. You can either fix the source of the problem, right? So if it's a difficult home situation, whether it's a company culture that's toxic and makes you feel horrible all day, you know, these are things that you could fix, but not everything in life can be fixed. The question is, you know, when you feel these uncomfortable sensations, what do you do? Do you look for escape? Do you look for pacification by reaching for something, right? Reaching for something to drink, reaching for something to eat, reaching something to take your mind off your problems with a device? Any of those things, you know, you have to ask yourself, is this what I want to be doing? Is this a helpful move to traction? Or am I doing this as a distraction from my discomfort? And so that's where we have to be conscious of how we are using that discomfort, because discomfort is not always a bad thing. You know, I think that there's a myth in the self-help community that somehow we're supposed to be happy all the time. How many books have happy and happiness in the title? It's ridiculous. That in fact, we are not designed to be happy all the time. Our species did not evolve to be constantly happy. That doesn't make any sense. That we need discomfort to drive us forward, to get us to invent, to create, to improve our lot in life. You need that spark, that desire for more. It's about how we utilize that spark. Do we escape from it, or do we use it as these boosters to help us do whatever it is we say we want to do?
From what you said, I have another question. You don't believe in happiness as such?
No. Happiness, joy, happiness, they definitely exist. It's that our goal shouldn't be to always be happy, right? There's no such thing as perpetual bliss. That I think people have gotten the message over the past few decades from self-help books that if you're not happy, something's wrong with you. You're broken. You need a pill. You need to read this book so that you can learn how to be happy. And they expect to always be happy. And that's ridiculous. That happiness, you know, the brain doesn't do what feels good. The brain does what felt good. And so it's that spike. The reason we have joy, happiness, elation is a temporary spike to remember what to do next time. That, neurologically speaking, is why we experience those sensations. Now, it's not that we have to be sad all the time. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we just can't expect to always be happy. And then what happens to a lot of people is that expectation actually leads to rumination, which makes them worse off. Why am I not happy? What's wrong with me? What's going on? And they look for reasons why they're not happy. And of course, if you look hard enough, you'll find them. It's the world these days. It's my spouse. This is pissing me off. My boss, that. There's lots of things that can make you unhappy if you look for them. But for many people, it's about this expectation, this unrealistic expectation that somehow feeling bad is bad. That's not true. That in fact, we can use discomfort to help us be better.
I remember reading one book, I don't remember what exactly it was, where they said that a great marriage or a happy marriage is when you're happy a little more than 50% of the time. So 51% is already considered to be a happy marriage. Like 49% of like the traction happening between the partner, friction happening is okay. It's something one can live with and should live with.
Yeah, that may be the case.
You've been teaching in Stanford for a number of years. Are there any specific techniques how you try to get your students hooked to studying, to learning processes?
You know, so the class was really focused on building products, designing products using technology products specifically. So, I mean, there was, you know, some things around in terms of there's a concept called the FOG behavior model, which is about, you know, it says that behavior is a function of motivation, ability, and a trigger. So what this says is that given a certain level of motivation, that a behavior is more likely to occur the easier the behavior is to do. This harkens back to Lewin's equation, who said that people's behavior is a function of their environment and their abilities. And so many times what we would do is, you know, to constantly consider, is this task easy enough to do? And providing the right level of challenge is important. That we want to make sure that you know, if we wanted students to complete a project, it had to be something that was easy enough to do. And that's of course directly relatable to any design experience. That, you know, design, whether it's interior design, graphic design, usability design, design is about manipulating behaviors or emotions. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. People want to be manipulated, right? If you walk into a building, you want the building architect to manipulate you to go down the right path and not, you know, bump into a wall somewhere. That's how we design buildings, so that they elicit certain feelings, certain behaviors. The same goes with usability design. It's about, you know, when you build an app, you want to manipulate people to go down a certain path. Now, manipulation has a negative connotation, but it doesn't always have to be the case. You know, there's two types of manipulation. There's persuasion and there's coercion. So persuasion is getting people to do things they want to do, whereas coercion is getting people to do things they don't want to do. So persuasion is, I think, is perfectly ethical and should be encouraged. I think far too many products are designed very poorly, that even when the user wants to use them, wants to work out, wants to do business with your company, wants to use your enterprise software or educational software, whatever the case might be, it's so poorly designed that it doesn't help the user do what they want to do. So we need more persuasive design. Coercive design is a different story. Coercive design is unethical. Coercive design is when a product tricks you, right? When you didn't realize that you were buying one thing and you got something else, or something was snuck into your cart online, right? You bought travel insurance when you didn't mean to, or you clicked on an ad that you thought was a news story. That would be a case of coercive design.
Valuable tips. Yeah, I know some people who answer their emails only once per week and nothing actually happens. They're not working for an ambulance. They do not need to extinguish any fires. So yeah, they decided, okay, one per...
It's more of a psychological need than it is a reality. Now, some jobs are not that case. You know, some jobs have a lot of what we call reactive work, where you're constantly reacting to phone calls, to emails, to messages. It's part of the job. And that's fine. You can schedule 4 times a day to respond to your emails. What many people do is that they leave the email open all day long. Mm. Right? Like, what's the point of that? That makes no sense. And that means you can't really focus on any one thing for very long because you're constantly checking email. So you have no time for what we call reflective work. Reactive work is when you're reacting to the emails, the meetings, the phone calls, the messages. Reflective work is when you're doing the kind of work that requires your full attention. And that's actually where we do our best work. That's the only place where we can do creative problem solving and strategic planning, is when we have time for focus.
Is there any time when you just turn off all of the devices and do this reflective kind of work? Does it happen
sure.
to you?
Every day when I write, writing is hard work. It hasn't gotten easier in the years I've been writing. I've written 2 books, countless articles. Writing is full of internal triggers. It's hard. I just want to escape for a minute. Let me just Google something real quick. I should probably do some more research. I should probably make a phone call. And I'm constantly filled with these internal triggers I seek to escape from. And so I can use, you know, part of what I talk about in the book is how you can use technology to hack back technology. That when I write, for example, on my phone, there's a feature that comes on every iPhone these days called Do Not Disturb While Driving. It's a beautiful feature, very few people have actually utilized. Here's how it works. Whenever you want to do focused work, whenever you want to do this reflective task, you can push this one button And if someone calls or texts you, they will receive an automatic reply that says, I can't talk right now, I'm driving. You can change that, by the way. Mine says, I can't talk, I'm indistractable. If this is urgent, text me with the word urgent. So if it's urgent, if, oh my God, your house is on fire, you have to call me right now, somebody texts the word urgent and now the call or the email comes through. I've been using this for years. Guess what? Nobody ever says it's urgent. It can wait. And so that's the truth. And when you start using these tools, on my laptop, I use an app called Self-Control. And Self-Control blocks out all the distracting websites. So I can't check email, I can't check Google, I can't check Wikipedia, I can't do all these things. Because when I write, I know that sometimes I'm tempted, even without thinking about it, right? I'll just, oh, let me just Google that. Oh yeah, I'm not supposed to be doing that right now because I said I want to do an hour of focused work. So I do this all the time. It's a very effective technique.
Mm-hmm. About writing, how much do you spend writing every day? Just out of curiosity.
Well, I go in phases based on what I'm working on. So when I'm in the middle of book writing, I'll maybe do 3 hours a day. But if I'm at, you know, just finished a book and now I'm just writing articles, then I typically maybe do 1 to 2 hours a day. And I reevaluate week over week. So if I have, I submit a story to the New York Times and they say, yeah, we want you to write it. Well, that means the week ahead, I'm going to look and say, okay, I need 2 hours every morning. And my writing time typically tends to be in the morning, 9:30 to 11:30. I hold that time. I don't take meetings. I don't take phone calls. I just do my writing time by holding it for myself in advance.
We already discussed this negative emotions, but you said that people with depression check email more often, which is kind of cool to pay attention to.
Yeah. And that's because of these internal triggers, right? It's wonderful proof around this fact that, when we feel these internal triggers, and so for a person struggling from clinical depression, they feel what we call these negative valence states. And so a negative valence state is when we feel down. And so a person who's suffering from clinical depression experiences those negative valence states more frequently throughout the day. And so they are more likely to check their devices to escape that discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Nir, one question about habits. Actually, it's two questions. One thing is, how can we best teach ourselves habits that we need? That's about ourselves. And an additional question to that is, how can we teach our children? For example, I have a 4-year-old girl. I mean, yes, it's a little early to get into habits, but I'm wondering what I can do as a parent to get her into a certain routine that will help her in the future when she grows up. And definitely she's gonna get her cell phone much earlier than I did, because when I was growing, cell phones, I mean, they were still in there for some time. For her, it's something that she sees every day in our hands, and sometimes she gets it, and definitely she gets into her hands the cell phone of her grandmother, and she already knows how to open some applications. Yeah. Could you give some advice, please?
Sure. So first of all, there's a whole section in Indistractable on how to raise indistractable kids. So you'd really love that section. There's a lot there. But big picture, the best thing you can do to raise indistractable kids, and by the way, this is there's no more important skill than this, that I think becoming indistractable is the skill of the century. I mean, if you think that the world is distracting now, just wait a few years. You know, the world that our kids will inherit will be even more distracting than the world is today, between virtual reality and augmented reality and who knows what other reality. There will be all kinds of things to distract them in the future. And so building this skill to do what they say they're going to do is an absolutely critical skill that we have to teach them. So how do we do that? We start by being indistractable ourselves. That, you know, children are born with these little hypocrisy detection devices, that children are constantly looking for where you screw up. And so we cannot tell our children, stop playing on Fortnite when we're checking Facebook. It doesn't work that way. We have to set a good example ourselves. We as parents need to become indistractable. And then the good news is that we can actually work through these four basic steps to become indistractable ourselves with our children. And it's the same four steps. Number one, mastering the internal triggers. We teach them a way to cope with this discomfort in a healthier manner, and also understand the deeper reason why kids could overuse technology. And for them as well, they are looking for some kind of escape. And so there's a fascinating theory in social psychology called the needs displacement hypothesis, which says that when a person does not get their psychological needs met offline, they look to meet those needs online. And so a big part of why kids overuse a technology or any distraction, whether it's television or radio or even books, you know, some kids read way too many books. If you're reading 5 hours a day of books, something's going on. You're looking for some kind of escape. And so any form of media that we overdo, we need to ask these deeper questions of what's going on. What are you looking to escape from? And so it's really about teaching kids those tactics to deal with those internal triggers in a healthier manner. Kids learn that stuff very, very quickly. Then the second step, making time for traction, right? Is there a schedule in our kids' life? For most kids, the day-to-day routines of school keeps that structure and schedule. But what a lot of parents don't realize is that there's nothing wrong with planning time for the screen time. That no study, not even one, has shown that over 2 years old, age-appropriate screen time has any deleterious effects. Not even one study. 2 hours or less, totally fine, as long as it's age-appropriate. And that two and under rule, even that rule, you know, they say there's this hard and fast rule, there hasn't been much research about it, that kids under 2 years old probably shouldn't have any screen time. That seems to not be exactly the case. That it's hard to argue that, you know, Skyping with your kid's grandmother is going to have negative effects. What I think psychologists don't want parents to do is to think of the iPad as an iNanny, right? You don't want to stick a device in front of a kid's face. You know, unfortunately, I see this all the time at restaurants. A family will be together, there'll be kids, and every kid has a device because the parents are using it as a pacifier. They don't want the kids to complain about being bored here. Watch this. And what you're doing is essentially stealing that skill of being okay sitting around the table and waiting for your food. That's something they're going to have to learn at some point in their life. And I think it's appropriate manners as well. And so having a schedule, however, helps them know that that time is coming, right? So yeah, absolutely. You can play Fortnite. You can go on, you can watch a YouTube video as long as the content is age appropriate. Here is when it's going to happen. It's in our schedule. We know it's coming. And then making sure that we can hack back the external triggers, just like we do with ourselves. We want to make sure that we don't have these potentially distracting external triggers in their environment where they can lead them off track. So a good rule of thumb, I often get asked, how do you know a child is ready to use a particular technology? And the rule of thumb is when they know how to turn it off. So if a child doesn't have the emotional maturity to leave the telephone on the charging station when they come to dinner, they're not ready for the device. If they don't know how to turn off the device or use do not disturb when they're doing their homework, they're not ready for the device. So we have to make sure they know how to use a device appropriately, just like swimming pools. You know, swimming pools kill countless children around the world. They're very dangerous, but we don't not let kids swim. We teach them how to swim. So there is an education process here that I think parents need to engage in. One rule of thumb, by the way, you know, part of what we've seen over the past few years is this correlation with some psychological disorders like depression, anxiety. We see rising in some countries, not all of them. And we think that there might be a correlation, not with the device per se, but what the device comes at the expense of, principally sleep, that children need adequate rest. And it drives me crazy when I see parents letting kids sleep with their cell phones or iPads or even television sets. Kids do not need anything in their room that potentially interrupts them in the middle of the night. Anything. No lights, no beeps, no boops, no televisions, no radios. They don't need that in the room. They can utilize that stuff. It's wonderful technology, but do it in a public space, not in their room where they could interrupt their sleep at night. And then making these pacts. I talk about in the book, the fourth critical step is about preventing distraction with pacts. And we can actually teach kids how to use technology to fight technology distraction. So there's a wonderful app that my daughter uses and I use as well called Forest. And Forest is this wonderful app that whenever you want to do focused work, you dial in how much time you want to spend doing that task. And then this little virtual tree is planted. Okay, now if you pick up your phone and you do anything with it, the little virtual tree dies. And so it's enough of a reminder, this cute little virtual tree. You don't want to kill the virtual tree. And so it's enough of a reminder to remind you, oh, that's not what you want to do right now. You want to stay focused on your homework. You want to keep doing this task that you're doing. Now is not the time. Just wait a few more minutes. And so we can actually use technology to prevent technology distraction.
This is really cool. I will definitely download Forest into my wife's iPhone as well. It's like, you know, I don't know whether you had this toy, but it was called Tamagotchi when I was studying at school. This little, like, sort of electronic animal that could die if you wouldn't feed it.
Yeah.
And it's a sapling of your deep work. Could we say, or could we teach our children that boredom is actually something that they should be okay with sometimes?
Sure, absolutely. And I think we can teach them that in a number of ways. And I think we should encourage that we could have time in their day. We do this in my family called unscheduled scheduled time. That mommy and daddy will be here breakfast, lunch, and dinner whenever, you know, if it's on a Saturday, we'll be here breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But mommy and daddy need time to do their own thing. Okay, we got to do laundry. We got to do some work. We got to do this and that. For that time, you've got unscheduled time for 2 hours. Okay, what do you want to do with that time? And you know, you already have your time that you're going to spend with the screen. So we have a rule in my household where we let my daughter come up with the rule for how much time she wants to spend on extracurricular screen time. And by the way, we did this when she was only 5 years old. We said, look, how much time do you think is appropriate for you to spend watching a YouTube video or playing on an app? Given, we didn't scare her. We didn't say, oh my gosh, it's going to rot your brain. It's bad for you. No, we said, look, the cost of too much screen time is the opportunity to do something else. Time with your friends, time with your parents, time reading a book, time doing something else. So how much time do you think is appropriate to spend with a screen? And she said 2 episodes. Now 2 episodes, she meant Netflix episode. That's about 45 minutes. So there's never been a study that says, you know, 2 hours or less of extracurricular screen time has any negative effect. So I was fine with 45 minutes. But here's the thing. I said, that's fine. You can have your 45 minutes, but how will you enforce your own rule? It now became her responsibility. And so she came up with this brilliant idea. She realized that, you know, we had this microwave that was below the countertop. It was like, below the shelf. And so she could walk up at 5 years old and push 4 or 5 clock or whatever it was, start, and it would beep when the 45 minutes were up. Now, this is amazing because now I'm not the bad guy, right? It's not daddy saying, put away your device, stop using it. She found a way to regulate her own behavior. Today, we actually don't use the microwave anymore. It's been years. She uses the technology. So she uses Amazon Alexa. She says, set the timer for 45 minutes. Or she uses screen time that comes on the Apple device to tell her when her time is up. So these tools are out there and we can teach our kids to use them, because here's the thing. Parents need to remember, we are not raising children. We are raising future adults. And so it behooves us to teach them these skills so that they can regulate their own behavior. If we restrict and say, no, 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 what's gonna happen when they go to their friend's house? You know what they're gonna do, they're gonna cheat. They're gonna find ways to do what they want, whether you like it or not. And so it's instead much better to teach them how to self-regulate as opposed to relying on you to be the boss to tell them what to do constantly.
By the way, that's not something I managed to say a little earlier. When you said about the mailings, about checking mailbox or text messages, WhatsApp, I considered myself to be kind of a smart guy. I'm not really hooked to Instagram, for instance. And when I noticed that I spent too much time on Facebook, I just stopped myself from doing that. But email was always my kind of a thing that I would fall for. It always feels like something important. And I realized, yes, I'm not playing a slot machine or like checking Instagram, but yes, I have something where I actually invest my energy, where I have my backups, I have my starred messages, I have my folders. And I realized, okay, there is space for improvement, even for a person who considers himself to be, I don't know, not a saint, but I mean, kind of not really hooked to the regular stuff.
Yeah. No, this is, I think email is probably the mother of habit-forming technologies, to be honest, because it uses all the tactics I described in my first book, even though no single entity owns email, not in the way that, you know, someone owns Facebook or Instagram. But it's one of these technologies that can be very distracting that we, for the most part, can't stop using. You know, how many people would get fired if one day you said, nope, I don't use email anymore. I'm on a digital detox. I'm doing digital minimalism. No more email. You'll get fired. You can't stop using it. But what we can do is use it better. And I talk about in the book how we can use email in a way that can significantly reduce the amount of time we spend on it. Most people don't realize that there's some very simple tactics that they can use to eliminate up to 90% of the time they waste on email.
Can you give some tips, maybe from your own experience, what you do yourself?
So there's a lot we can do. There's a basic formula that total time spent on email is a function of the number of emails you receive multiplied times the number of minutes you spend per email. So those are the two levers, how many emails you receive and how much time you spend per each message. And so there's a kind of a list of many different techniques you can use, but one of the most productive is to realize that the time you waste on email, when they do time studies, the time wasted on email is not the checking, it's not the replying, it's the rechecking. So when you get an, this is what many people do, they get an email and they open the email and they read it and they put it away. And then they open it, they read it, and they put it away. They do this again and again and again, and that wastes a tremendous amount of time. And so what we want to do instead, the reason this happens is because we don't realize that we forget what's in the email. And so we open it, and we say, okay, when does it need to reply? And what did that person say? And is it really urgent? What's going on? And that's a huge time waster. So instead, we want to set a rule that we only touch each email two times. The first time is when we receive the email. And the second time is when we reply to the email. We don't recheck. Now, what do we do to make sure that doesn't happen? Every time you receive an email, you have to ask yourself a very important question. The most important question from a time management perspective is not what's in the email. The content is not what's super important. The only thing you need to focus on is asking yourself, when does this message need a reply? Okay, when does this message need a reply? Then you can bucket into a few different categories. If it never needs a reply, well, then just delete or archive it. If it needs a reply, oh my God, right this minute, this is super urgent, your house is on fire, that almost never ever happens, but okay, you're allowed to respond to it. If it's really a critical emergency, not somebody at work needs a spreadsheet, but an emergency. The other two categories, and this is 99% of your email, falls into one of two categories. Emails that need to be returned today and emails that can wait sometime this week. And if you use the labeling functionality, every email program has labeling functionalities. Google it, depending on your service provider, whether it's Gmail or Outlook or whatever. When you get that email, you just want to categorize it with a label, not based on what's in the email. Don't use category labels, just based on when they need a reply. So either today or this week. Then you're going to have time in your calendar to only respond to the emails you need to respond to today. Okay, the urgent emails that need a response today. And you have that time boxed. So you know at specific intervals throughout the day, you will get to those emails and reply to them, but only the ones for today. Okay, so it doesn't matter to me how often you do that as long as you do it in advance. Whether you like to check email four times a day, or you're the kind of person who just wants to plow through all of today's messages, you know, in a 1 hour block, whatever it is you want to do, only reply to those emails when you have time on your calendar specified for that. Why? If you don't, you're going to do what most people do, which is every time I'm bored, check email. Every time I'm uncertain about what to do, check email. Every time I'm anxious, check email. Huge waste of time. Only do it when that time on your calendar. Now, here's where the magic happens, okay? You're going to, every time you open the email, you're going to label it either by today or this week. And here's how you're going to reduce the number of messages you need to reply to. How does this happen? There's a secret magic that happens when you let emails marinate. Here's what happens. It's an amazing thing. You will find that for those emails that you said, yeah, I need to reply sometime this week, anywhere from 20 to 50% of those emails, if you just give it a little time, don't need to be replied to. People figure out their own issues. They solve their own problems. Something that was super important a few days ago turns out to not be that important anymore because something else is even more important now. And so by giving email some time to marinate, what you're doing is reducing the need to even reply to many of those emails that can wait sometime this week. And so what I do, I have a time called Message Mondays. Every Monday afternoon, I have 3 hours where for those 3 hours, I work through all the emails that can wait sometime this week. And I clear through those. Now, it doesn't matter how much time you spend, you can adjust that week to week. But I know that is the time to reply to those urgent emails and no other time. And so here's why this is so effective, because here there's a very simple rule that most people don't realize. If you want to receive fewer emails in a given period of time, you have to send fewer emails in a given period of time. Because what most people do is at the top of their email list, they just reply to whatever's at the top of their inbox, whether it's urgent or not, because it feels like they're ticking off to-dos. But what they don't realize is if you send someone an email that didn't need a reply right now, that email is going to come right back, right? They're going to play this ping pong game back and forth and back and forth that wastes everybody's time. So do yourself a favor, slow down the email ping pong game and only reply. It's about 20% of your emails on average actually need a reply today, and the rest can wait sometime this week, and you'll find that a good chunk of them don't need a reply at all if you give them some time.
Near tons of golden nuggets. Thank you very much for your
My
time.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really great. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. All right. Keep in touch.
Keep in touch. Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.